Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 3 of The Unsafe Space. My name is Keith Redmond. I'm a former Fine Gael councillor in Fine Gael County Council. I'm joined by my beloved and sidekick, Sarah Ryan.
I'm the main event. You're the sidekick.
Introduce yourself there.
My name is Sarah Ryan. I'm a former Fianna Fáil councillor.
That's like an AA meeting.
Yeah, I'm the main event. Keith, this is a side plate.
Anyway, you're all very welcome to The Unsafe Space. Today we're going to talk about Sarah's hobby horse, which is criminal justice, and how lenient she perceives it to be. And we'll get into some of the differences between she and I. I mean, I'm a libertarian by nature. Sarah would be more, I think, of a proper conservative on certain issues. So we're gonna get into that a little later. But I think we'll just so it's criminal justice. We're gonna also talk about immigration, hot button issue that nobody's allowed to talk about. And we're also gonna talk about the EU. So
the clue's in the name of this podcast. We're gonna talk about a few things that if people like safe spaces, they shouldn't come here because this is an unsafe space.
And, yeah, if you're fairly easily triggered, you've hit the wrong podcast.
If you think feelings matter more than facts, you should probably leave now. So basically what I wanted to talk about was this thing this week about a judge giving this guy a suspended sentence, last chance sentence, when he had 648 convictions already. And I think that, you know, obviously I'm a Fianna Fáiler, but one of the things I would have had some, you know, respect for in the past would have been the fact that Fine Gael would have been very much seen as the law and order party. But I think, like, you know, every other ideological standpoint they have, that's gone now. And you know, there's literally zero law and order party in Ireland now. And I'm not talking about, you know, being completely crazy about it, but it's 648, like, just it's just staggering to me that somebody can commit 648 crimes and be still going around with a suspended sentence. I mean, it's like the judicial system is just a joke, and there are criminals who just do whatever they want with absolutely zero consequences at all. And as a taxpayer, as somebody who is living in this country, paying taxes, trying to, you know, just get by and trying to not break the law myself, I just find it pretty appalling that that even happens and that that's allowed to happen. And I think that a party that comes out and starts getting taking a really hard line on this kind of nonsense is going to do well.
Well, you would say that, but I was also in Renua, and Renua came out with a three strikes and you're out policy for violent crime. And I mean, it wasn't all crime, it was violent crime. So, and that was obviously utterly rejected along with everything else Renua put out, the flat tax and all the other stuff I liked. But so I don't know if a majority of people actually do think that way. I think that, you know, there is this feeling, whether you call it a post-colonial kind of feeling that, like, you know, we should all be able to get around the system or wangle the system, or, well, you know, my little Johnny had, you know, problems growing up and therefore they all have to be brought in. Whenever a judge is looking at the mitigating circumstances, it seems to me that, you know, all the little Johnnies all had terrible upbringings and therefore they can't be sent to prison. But from my point of view, I think that we put people in prison who shouldn't be in prison, and they take up space for the people who really should be. So we put, for example, people in prison for not having TV licenses, for reneging on debts and, you know, issues like that, where I don't think it should be within an ass's roar of a prison. But for people who are committing crimes against the person, as it were, whether that's violent crimes or thefts and burglaries and those kind of things, I think, yeah, those guys should be in prison.
I mean, like, people who are 648 convictions, that people who are spending their lives going around causing misery to other people, like, the law is supposed to be there to stop them.
Yeah, but what would you do with that guy? Would you put him in prison for the rest of his life?
No, I wouldn't put him. Like, I'm not a lunatic.
Right, but so,
like,
what would you do?
But I think that he should have been in prison by now. I think if you've got, it didn't say specifically what the 648 convictions were. So to your point, the 648 convictions could be all related to TV licenses, for all we know. And I couldn't care less about that. And I don't think anybody should be going to jail for any of that stuff. But let's be honest, 648 crimes, they're not TV license crimes. They're a lot of theft, I'm sure, and a lot of social disorder kind of things. And I think that he should have gone to jail by now. And I think he should have gone to jail for probably 3 years.
But I think, you know, if you have somebody
like
who's...
Our general conviction rate against crimes, even sexual crimes, is horrendous.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, people, even murder, we don't take a hard line. People should be going and doing some serious time for certain types of crime. And if somebody breaks into your home and, like, beats you up or threatens your family or has a knife or has a weapon or whatever, I think that the punishment for those kind of crimes should be 10 to 15 years. And I don't care.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, you know, the recent sentencing for so-called tiger kidnappings and home invasions has been really pretty substantial. And I've kind of thought it was fantastic, to be honest. I mean, over 16, 18 years, this kind of stuff. But when you consider that a quarter of that is taken off automatically for remission and good behavior, and, you know, these guys always tend to get out nowhere near serving the time that they should. Murder is a good one. I mean, allegedly everybody who commits a murder is convicted is given a life sentence.
But, sure.
But their first parole hearing, now very few get it, but their first parole hearing is held after 7 years. And then it's, you know, 13 and 16 and so. And, you know, really, I genuinely think we need to get to the stage where we have a proper, you know, 25 to life is your murder rate. And I don't think you'd find any objection to that. But for some reason,
why is no party willing to come out?
No party has ever done it. I don't understand.
Well, Fine Gael used to be the self-proclaimed law and order party. Where did that go?
Well, Fianna Fáil have been in government for 80% of the time of the state.
Fine Gael, that's a great old yarn. But Fine Gael have been in government for long enough, Keith, as well, you know. And I've seen not a lot about sentencing, but a lot about socks.
Yeah. Okay, look. I think you're right. I think that we definitely should, and we could have seen at this stage a very popular measure to increase the sentencing for example, murder. I know Jim O'Callaghan, the Fianna Fáil justice spokesman, has had something buried in second committee about increasing the minimum.
Yeah, he does. Yeah,
to 12 years or something. But even the fact that he chose only 12 years just shows you where the vast majority of politicians' heads are at.
But he's in opposition as well. But so, like, at least he's saying something.
He's kind of in opposition. He's kind of not. I mean, he could get that through if he wanted to. But even still, what I'm trying to say.
So what you're saying is that. Actually having the audacity to say is that Fianna Fáil should be writing law and order policy when they're propping up this government, but the government get a free pass on not doing it.
Yeah, but Fianna Fáil are writing lots of different laws. That's part of this confidence in supply.
Bullshit. Fine Gael are supposed to be the leader. Fine Gael are in government. Fianna Fáil are not in government.
Well, Fianna Fáil are in government.
They're not in government, Keith. It's confidence in supply.
This is a smoke and mirrors thing. They're not in government. They're in coalition. They just didn't take ministerships. That's all.
And do you think they would do that? They're not in government. They're not in government. That's old trope that people in Fine Gael and outside say when Fine Gael is making a hames of something or not doing something, then they land it over onto Fianna Fáil and say, oh, Fianna Fáil should be doing the Irish, Fianna Fáil, oh, sure, they're... That's all crap. Fianna Gael are in government. And you said in the last podcast, and you were happy to do so, that Francis Fitzgerald was introducing legislation about prostitution. And wasn't it a terrible thing that she did? So why doesn't Francis Fitzgerald introduce... why didn't Francis Fitzgerald introduce laws about sentencing? Because she didn't. Because they're not the law and order party.
I agree with you.
Because they talk out of the side of their mouth.
I think Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are at fault here.
As you say, they were in opposition for long enough and they exercised their jaws plenty on law and order when it was easy for them to do so from the back benches of the opposition. But now, when they're in government, they do sweet FA and they just blame everybody else for it.
No, I think you're right. I think that Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are both at fault here. They have been running the country for 80 years and neither party have introduced legislation that I think the vast majority of the public would want on violent crime, sexual crime, and even recidivist
murders. The only policy that's been put forward that we can even mention has come forward from a Fianna Fáiler.
Yeah, and even that's not gotten through and it's still mealy-mouthed. 12 years for a murder charge now.
But it's better than 7.
Yeah, but it's also not enough. And the point is, it should be 25 minimum. But I suppose when you're coming back to your example there of 648 convictions, when you get to the stage where you're a criminal, lifelong criminal, obviously, of a kind of a steroidally recidivist nature, the notion of rehabilitation is laughable. That's not going to happen. So,
well, I would make the case that if he is committed 648 crimes and never been taken to task on any of them, that no one's even attempted to rehabilitate him.
But we don't know that he's not spent some time in prison. All he says is this one, he was given a suspended sentence. Okay. So I think that, anyway, it's not going to work is the bottom line. And the vast majority, and it comes back to what we discussed in the previous podcast on drugs and the harm that drugs can cause. One of the harms that drugs causes, and it's generally for addictive drugs like heroin, is that people have to commit multiple minor crimes over and over and over to get the money for these drugs. And so the harm that they inflict on society, the wider society, as a result of their drug addiction, can be reduced by legalizing and using,
for example, hope.
It would be, because they wouldn't need to commit the crimes to get the money. So for example, if heroin was available to them, if they went down to their GP, you know, and they collected their heroin, that'd be so much cheaper for society to give them free heroin than it would be to put them through courts, put them into prisons. The impact they have on people's burglaries. I mean,
would be happy for your tax money to be going unspent and giving free heroin to people.
Far, far, far happier, because it would be cheaper and I would use far less of my tax money on them. Because otherwise I'm going to be using the money for guards arresting them, judges jailing them, prisons holding them, and all of the rest of it.
Well, prisons aren't holding them.
Yeah, well, the point is that most of our prisons are full of people related to drug crime. So if we had a situation where we were, I'm not going to go back over that podcast, but it's one of the issues that it reduces the harm to wider society as well. But those 648 convictions are not being...
Tell that to the kid who's being pushed around town in a buggy by two heroin addicts, though, Keith. It's costing nobody nothing, but the kid's life is a complete mess.
And will always be. I mean, there's nothing that can be done there, because unless you're willing to get the state to step in and take parental rights away, that's not going to happen either. So, you know, that doesn't change because it's illegal. It's illegal currently and it's happening. So that's not going to change. Anyway, we're not going to rehash that. The point is that this guy is unreachable by rehabilitation. He's unreachable by one of the issues for our prison services allegedly about rehabilitation.
At least 648 people out there who have been the victim of a crime at his hands.
Well, they're the ones that we caught him.
Who I think the state owes something too.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, why do we pay taxes? State owes us to provide us, insofar as is possible, with a society that is safe, that we can walk around, that we can expect to, you know, not be robbed or stabbed or attacked or beaten up or whatever. And if people are going around committing 648 crimes and not being, you know, and continuing to walk around as if on probation, then it's failing.
It is failing. But I think, again, we have to... is there an appetite for, you know, either of the main parties to take this on? What are we missing? I would have thought that there is an appetite and yet neither of them do it. So is there some reason that they're afraid to do it?
I don't think there's a reason why they're afraid to do it, but I don't think it's particularly a hot topic, because the people that it matters the most to are the people who are the victims of the crime, and they're probably not in enough numbers to make it a real issue.
It's like this thing you always say, and I think I agree, like, that nobody wins or loses votes on the health system. You know, a lot of noise is made around the health system, but people don't vote on the health system because, you know, the vast majority of us are not engaged in the health system when an election happens. And so...
Yeah, it's the same with, like, obviously it's topical for us now, but, like, because we have a 2.5-year-old and a 6-month-old, so, you know, we've obviously have our own arrangements and we've had loads of conversations about childcare. But 5 years ago, neither you or I gave a tuppenny damn about childcare because it didn't affect us at all. The problem with childcare is that you always, you know, you'd have politicians say they talk a good game about it. But childcare is an issue that affects people deeply, but only for a certain amount of time.
Short period, yeah.
And then the kids go to school and they have another blah, 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 and then they kind of lose interest. It's not a lifelong issue. And when things aren't, and hospitals are the same, you have a parent who's sick, you have them, they're not long, they're absolutely hugely important at the time, and they should be addressed, and not, by no means am I saying that they shouldn't, but they never quite seem to get the same momentum as other people because they're flash in the pan for a lot of people. They're for a short period, you know, they get on with it, they give out about it or whatever, and then they move on with their life. And, you know, it's like anything. It's like people who are on the housing list, and I remember this from being a counsellor. And my dad always used to say this as well, like if you had clinics and stuff like that, that if somebody came to talk to you about an issue, you always had to understand that whatever they'd come to you to talk about was the biggest issue in their life. So if it is a housing, you know, that they're on a housing list and they've been on a housing list for 8 years, like that is the absolute center of their life. And that's totally understandable, but and you should treat it as such. And, you know, I think that unless an issue is the center of the universe for enough people, they just don't get the traction. And politicians, they're not, they don't become the thing at which a TD does or doesn't get elected on.
It's like housing. Yeah, housing's an interesting one because it's the kind of the topic of the day, the topic du jour at the moment.
Yeah.
But the vast, vast majority of people have a house. And so, you know, even though a lot of light and noise is made in the media about housing, again, it doesn't really gain enough traction in the kind of the political mind, because voters don't vote on housing because they...
Well, it's terrible, but there's a lot of people who just go in and vote, and they vote on the issues that affect them personally.
But that's the way voting has always been, yeah.
And yeah, I suppose it's selfish. So people go in, and a huge amount of people go in and they vote on, you know, like, what's that expression they say? Like, that there's a politician, he said it, I'm messing it up now, but basically the gist of it was that people will vote for you if they have enough money to pay their mortgage, pay for their kids' education, and have a holiday at the end of the year. And once you start to mess with that general, and obviously we're talking about certain types of people, but whatever. But if you don't mess with that, you're fine, and people will just continue to vote for big parties and status quo. Now they might get, like, that person might get particularly, you know, like, caught up with the criminal justice concept if they get mugged, or if something happens, or the house gets broken,
or whatever,
or if they get sick, or they go into the house, their mother gets sick, and they're sitting on a trolley and all, and then they get all vexed about it. But by and large, it doesn't affect them, so they don't vote on it. But at the same time, I think that there is, you know, a space there that one of the parties needs to grab a hold of, and that is the criminal justice system, that is sentencing, that we need to start being tougher on these kind of things, that there should be better, you know, that there are people who are going to prison who shouldn't be, but there are people who aren't going to prison who definitely should be.
But, I honestly can't see the downside of somebody coming out really strong on sentencing, especially for recidivist criminals and murderers.
Then you just get painted as this right-wing lunatic.
But this is the point. If you're painted as that and yet the vast majority of people are in agreement with you, it doesn't really matter. It comes to the Peter Casey effect, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he said something that a lot of people were thinking that no one else was saying, and he got rewarded for it.
In votes, because people were able to, and it comes back to that you were saying earlier on, when people say, oh, I saw you said this on Twitter, I saw you said this on, oh, you're so brave, or whatever. They go into the ballot box and they vote. So, like, Peter Casey said something that a lot of people secretly thought. And, you know, whether or not you agree with what he said is really irrelevant. The issue is that he captured something that is quiet in Irish society. And what happens is that when you have a situation where people feel like they're not allowed to ask any questions, they're not allowed to say anything, or they'll be branded as a racist or a xenophobe or whatever, they still vote that way, but they just don't say anything. And you never get to challenge their beliefs. You never get to argue it out. You never get to do it. This is the quality of debate. It's not high. Like, there's nothing wrong with a 65-year-old woman who lives in rural Ireland being worried about immigration. There's nothing wrong with that. That's natural. The point is that the debate and the media and all should comfort her. The debates, and she should be able to watch TV and say, actually, there's somebody who thinks like that, who's arguing this point and arguing again, and it's being argued against. Instead, it's just shut down, you're this, you're that, the other. And what happens is that somebody like Peter Casey comes out, says a couple of stupid things, and seems like he's some sort of messiah, yeah, because he's just saying something that they've never heard anybody else say before. Doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. But, like, I just saw all these things on Twitter at the time being like, Peter, anybody who voted for Peter Casey is a racist, and anybody, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, that is to me a fundamental misunderstanding of what's happening there. What's happening there is that somebody has come out, and ignore it at your peril, that there are people who feel like they're not being represented by the discourse, they're not being represented by the debate, and they should be, like, taken, that should be taken on board. Like, no social change, no progress has ever been made by just completely alienating an entire section of people and calling them names. That worked out well. Like, it just doesn't work that way.
You can't shut down, you know, conversation or debate in civil society about a topic by saying it's beyond, you know, discussion. We're just simply not allowed to discuss it. You're not allowed to say, you know,
but you
give
can.
Your opinion.
And we used to do that, but and it did not turn out very well.
It doesn't work. It never works. And it hasn't worked in any country because it eventually finds its way through the cracks. It finds its way up the walls. It eventually comes out in some kind of demagoguery or somebody who comes along, as you say, seems to be a messiah saying all the things that people are thinking, when really the political system is at fault because it should be discussing those issues and giving reassurance to that 65-year-old woman in rural Ireland and saying, look, is it not instinctive, you know, fear that comes from evolutionary almost fear that comes up when you think about X, Y, or Z? But I'm going to comfort you by discussing that you feel this way because of this, and here's why we're going to here's the way we're going to dissuade that fear.
But this, I'll give you a good example. So I'm, you know, often on a panelist on TV3, and a couple of years ago I said on the show that on the Elaine show, I said that I thought that Donald Trump was going to get elected, and I was annihilated by people on Twitter. And I was like, I didn't say anything about Donald Trump. I just said I think that he is going to win. And it was like as if I'd said a blasphemous thing. Like, yeah, they were outraged at me. Like, how can you say that, whatever. But again, it's not, there's nothing, like, it was literally just a political prediction. I didn't say anything positive about Donald Trump. I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, but who cares if I am or I am not. I was just making a political prediction. Mm. And even that was just absolutely offensive and hurt feelings all around, because I made a projection that turned out, go me, to be true. And all I was, and what I subsequently said then, again, was that I was making the prediction on the basis that there was a huge cohort of people, I think like 40% of the American workforce hadn't had a pay rise in 20 years. And so they were increasingly getting frustrated with the political system, and that it wasn't providing them with anything. And then this guy comes along and he says a few stupid things, but they've never heard anybody talk like that before, and they go, well, I'll have a punt on him, let's go for it. That was the entire thing. That's what happened with Peter Casey, and that's what will continue to happen until people start being a bit more mature, being a little bit more inclusive, saying, okay, I don't agree at all with what this person has said, but I'm going to have a mature and reasoned debate with them. I'm not going to tell them to shut up and call them racist, because that doesn't get us anywhere.
You can't sanitize speech to the point where words are forbidden, and you know, you can just hope that those thoughts go away. The thoughts don't go away, they're just unspoken. And so, you know, I think personally Peter Casey's a flash in the pan. I don't think we're going to see or hear much about him, but he was a little warning shot across the bows of politicians that they need to start discussing these things, you know.
Yeah.
You need to start having those difficult conversations and saying things that, yeah, you're going to get excoriated for on Facebook for even mentioning, because as we know, there's a huge push now to police speech to the point where you're not allowed to say this, you're not allowed to say that, and the secular blasphemy thing that I bang on about. So the notion that, you know, you do have to be brave, as you say, but saying something on Twitter, knowing a mob is coming for you as a result, politicians are going to have to start getting brave in this country, because otherwise you're leaving an open field to some other loony bag who's going to come along and say all the things that people are thinking. And it will be your fault. If you're a senior politician in Ireland and you're not willing to discuss these issues, it's going to be your fault.
And by the way, just for clarity, we're not talking about incitement to hatred. There is a law against that already. Yeah. Like, you can't say, you're not talking about allowing people to go on, you know, TV and radio and say completely offensive, racist, like hate inciting comments. Well,
things that incite to violence. That's illegal and should be illegal, you know.
Anyway, the point is, we're talking about having adult debates about real issues instead of sitting around having citizens assembly about gender equality.
Yeah, because you're offended by what somebody says. I think, you know, we're in the era of competitive outrage. You know, you have to be more outraged than the last person. You have to be more offended than the last person. I'm always intrigued by people who say to me on Twitter, you know, oh, I'm offended by what you said. And then they finish the sentence as if I'm supposed to just stop then. I go, well, just don't be. I don't really get it. Like, don't be offended. That's your issue, not mine.
But there's just a level of kind of like insanity that's crept into
it's
like
childishness.
But like, who cares? cares? Like, I mean, I don't expect anybody. There's loads of people on TV or things that I wouldn't go so far as to say I find them offensive, but I think they're stupid, or there's politicians that I don't particularly agree with anything they say or whatever. But like, I just don't think the world owes it to me not to hurt my feelings.
Yeah, well, I mean, people who say that we should increase taxes, I find that really offensive. I think they should stop saying that. If they could.
But facts don't care about your feelings, and everybody's entitled. I mean, I just think the very idea that somebody, like, you love Twitter, right? You love it.
Yeah.
I'm not really that much of a fan, because I just think, like, sometimes, like, I kind of go, as you know, like, I kind of go through stages and I'll say something and, you know, like, I'll write something occasionally and then, you know, I'll either get a bit of a thrill out of the fact that loads of people like it and it's all lovely or whatever, or I'll crawl under the duvet because there's someone from North Carolina is calling me names and I'm like, what is happening and why is this, why am I doing this? But I think it's just gas that there are people who go on, follow people they don't like, wait for them to offend them, and then jump on it and be like, I'm offended by what you say. Like, A, why are you offended? Yeah. B, why are you following him? And C, why do you care? Why do you think he cares?
Yeah.
Like, it's an incredible kind of self-delusion or something. Like,
I used to block people who became like completely over the top and were constantly contacting me with, you know, calling me names. I used to block them. But now I don't. I mute them, which is fabulous, because I like to think that they're still out there thinking I can hear them, you know? And so it's just nicer to mute people. But I've gotten to the stage now where I don't know whether it's a thick skin after doing 5 years in the council or whether it's just from having these discussions over and over, but I genuinely do not care if you're offended by something that I say. That is your childish, you know, kind of
outrage,
feelings, emotions, yeah. And you can't control your emotions. So this is your problem. You can't control your emotions. It's your issue to fix. Go away and fix it. Come back to the adult world when you're ready to do it. But don't have a conversation with me and expect me to, you know, expect to win the argument with me by saying you're offended and I have to stop. That's not going to happen. And I think we need more and more people need to start coming out against this, you know, I'm offended, you know, narrative, this era of outrage, the era of offense, which is shutting down conversation. So we need to just stand up. One of the other issues we were going to discuss there was, and it was touched on by Peter Casey, but I mean, I'm no fan of Peter Casey, but he was talking about immigration. So, you know, we seem to have this reflex, like a twitch, when anybody mentions immigration. You're not allowed to talk about immigration, and the hot button issue in Ireland is direct provision. What do you feel about direct provision?
I think direct provision is just absolutely disgraceful. Like, I just can't understand how I'm embarrassed that I live in a country where people are left for 6-7 years going to a canteen every day with their kids. Just absolutely horrific. I think that it's a failure of the state. It's a failure of the system. And I think also it just so, like, invites disenfranchisement. Like, how, like, there's kids are becoming adults doing their leaving cert and can't go to college because they're in direct provision. Like, come on.
But it's, you see, is that
I
not
think
a
it should just be an absolute priority to fix the system so that if you arrive and you're seeking asylum, you go through a process, the process is fair, and there is an end. Not this. They've literally, like, you know, the church apparently got rid of limbo at one point, and the state has reintroduced it.
Yeah, but it's a function. I mean, they were actually going to do, I remember when Éowyn Reardon was the junior minister for integration and whatever else, and he had a big bee in his bonnet about direct provision. He stood up on a podium one day, and I remember, and he said, you know, I'm the man who's going to end this, right? And he brought all of the groups of migrants, rights, Ireland, and all they all stood behind him, and they all believed him. And as is the case often with Éowyn stuff, it tends to be the Duke of York. He brings him up a hill and then brings him down again. But
don't get catty now.
But anyway, he had this thing where he was going to end it all. And the senior minister, who was Francis Fitzgerald at the time, said, no, if we get rid of it, that would be a pull factor for more migrants, and we're not going to end it. And that was the end of that. But it was kind of a function of the fact that it took 7, 8, 9, 10 years to get through our asylum system. So really what you need is an asylum system which is done and dusted in 12 months. But that would require an awful lot, not only of legislation, but potentially even a referendum, because we would need to, the legal system is so is so convoluted and can be abused by clever lawyers to the point where delay becomes a tactic, and you're trying to appeal this appeal and that appeal. And we were led to believe that it was going to be streamlined and it was all going to be very quiet, and nothing changed. But the direct provision system in and of itself is indefensible. But it's a product of the fact that the system itself is indefensible. The system has failed. It's not even failing. It has failed. And unless you can get through an appropriate asylum system within 12 to 18 months, then really at that stage, your system has failed. If anybody is in direct provision for more than 5 years, I think you owe them an amnesty.
They've been in jail.
I mean, they've been in a horrific situation. And that's a failure. I mean, you just have to do
Would
it.
Would you not consider ringing up Aon and sitting down with him and having a chat and like coming up with some ideas together and like really pushing this idea forward?
Aon and I agree with the drug decriminalisation. Other than that, Aon and I disagree on everything.
Ah, but you love to hate him.
I do love to hate him, and I'm sure he loves to hate me too.
But I actually don't think you really hate each other. I think you like each other.
No, I like Aon personally, but I just think that his politics is cynical, and his politics is just, you know, he says all the right things because he wants to seem to be so right on and get all the votes. And I don't really think he believes half of it. I really don't think he believes half of it. So, I mean, we'll have to get Aon on the show.
Well, I think that's the scary thing about politics, is that I think, I don't know what's more terrifying, that most of the politicians that we have elected don't really believe half of what they say, or the politicians like you who aren't elected believe everything that they say.
You got to have belief to be in politics. You just have to believe. Like, but the belief is you got to believe you're getting elected.
There's literally, like, there's more wiggle room in, I don't know, there's just, there's, you're, the lady is not for turning over there.
Yeah, well, we need a bit more principle in politics in Ireland. We need somebody who has actual backbone and who is going to stand up for certain principles and not waver.
We have loads of them. They're always on the bottom and the also-rans.
Yeah, they don't win.
You know, on elections,
they don't win.
They get 167 votes.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're there.
But that's you know what? Maybe that's a conversation that we need to have too. I mean, you get the politicians you deserve because voters vote for these people, and maybe it's because they actually represent what voters think. Well, voters don't want to make a hard decision on certain things. They like wishy-washy politicians. They like wishy-washy political parties. They like a bit of a catch-all for everybody kind of politics. And that's, we're alone in Europe and not never really having a left and right in our politics. In as much as people are always accusing Fine Gael of being, you know, right-wing, Jesus, I mean, yeah, 50% income taxes are get
over
yourself.
That sounds great. So, that sounds great. But like the thing is that what I would argue is that, but that has come so far that we're actually not a catch-all for everybody anymore, because there's a huge amount of people who are becoming disenfranchised by that new politics. Like, people don't like to talk about it, but like one in every three people you meet voted against repealing the Eighth Amendment. Who represents those people?
Yeah.
Like, you know, they're still voters, they're still taxpayers, they're still worthy of, you know, representation. There's lots of people who are not represented by the current political discourse, and they deserve to be represented. So fine, maybe a lot of Irish people just like wishy-washy politics, but wishy-washy politics is leaving a lot of people out in the cold.
Yeah, but again, it goes back to the voters. Those voters you mentioned, say like pro-life voters or whatever, they don't vote pro-life when it comes to general elections. They just don't do it. So if that was the case, then you would have Renew and Aintu on, you know.
Well, Aintu did really well in local elections, to be fair.
Yeah, but they don't. I still think that was more of an affinity for Pat or Tobin rather than the pro-life thing. I just don't think we have pro-life single-issue voters in Ireland. We just don't. They just go back to the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael afterwards.
Okay, but the pro-life voter is not the only disenfranchised voter. I think it's there's an entire swathe of Irish society who don't speak up about things because they're afraid to. What we were saying earlier on, oh, you're very brave to say that. I secretly think this, but I said we have our neighbours who are a bit older than us, and we get on really well with them, and are they 80 and 70?
70s.
And remember, they had a dinner party and they invited us, and everybody at the dinner party except us was a septuagenarian or whatever. And but they all had these
great crack.
It was so much fun, and they all like to drink you under the table and great crack. But they all had loads of strong opinions about loads of things, and every time any of them said anything, the more drink there was, the more honest they got. And every time any of them said anything, I observed they would say, "But you can't say that anymore. But you can't say that anymore." And some of it was, you know, mildly offensive, but like a lot of it was fairly mainstream stuff. But they were just afraid to say anything, and I think that there's something wrong with that.
Yeah. Well, that's you know. why, again, it comes back to that's a failure of the political system, because nobody is having the debates, even if they don't agree with it. They should be saying, look, we need to talk about this because we need to bring those people with us.
Yeah, fine.
You know, on the journey. But like the...
But like, I love going to a dinner party. Like, I don't know what happened, but like, I love going to a dinner party or over to someone's house for a drink or whatever, and there's somebody there that completely disagrees with you and you have a great old Barney with them. I love that. What? When did that become like wrong? Well, now everybody sits around and holds hands and watches, you know, TV together, and like, I don't know, like, arguing has somehow become kind of
it's offensive.
Offensive. And yeah, like... Yeah, like I've been in company before where I walk in and I can immediately feel that like me and my politics and the way I think is automatically offensive to people, and they're kind of off and rude and, you know, whatever to you. And that's fine. I don't mind that. I, like, for example, not a Sinn Féin voter, never ever will be, couldn't imagine in a million years voting for Sinn Féin. But like, when I was on the council and stuff like that, I had especially one or two like good pals in Sinn Féin. Like, I don't agree with anything they say, but I can get on with people who don't have the same opinion.
This is the thing. The ability to get on with people you disagree with seems to have been lost in this culture war where you're not allowed to even like their jacket. You know, I mean, I have on Fingal County Council, I had like really good friends who are very left wing. And, you know, that's fine. That's their viewpoint. They're putting it across. And obviously, if the revolution comes, they're going to shoot me first. But the point is that, like, at the moment, I get on fine with them. And you can do that if you're a mature person who's able to recognize the difference between an individual and their beliefs. But right now,
it's not the ability to argue that's gone. There's a maturity that's gone out of it that you can't say
it's childishness.
Like, I don't agree with you, but like, we get on grand and we can have a debate, and at the end of it we can just go, well, I don't agree with you and you don't agree with me, but that's okay. Instead, it's, you're offensive to everything I am, you need to be destroyed, you need to be taken off. Like, you know, like I was saying in one of the previous podcasts, like, people like Kevin Myers and George Hook, whatever, like, kill the beast, like, get rid of them. Or why? Like,
deplatforming people. Deplatform is just censorship. So let's censor that person. They're not allowed to say, let's censor that person. So they invented a new word. Let's deplatform them, which sounds really fancy.
But that's the irony of it, is the saying, like, you know, sitting there and saying it was terrible years ago when they silenced women, and they wouldn't allow unmarried mothers to speak up, and they wouldn't allow this woman in the guards to speak up, and they wouldn't allow this. But now someone said something I don't like, so get rid of them, take them off everything. I don't want to never ever let them speak again. Maybe put them into somewhere that we never have to see or look at them ever again. I hope he loses his job and his house and his wife and everything. I hope he's gone forever.
But like, that's secular blasphemy.
You're just the same. You're the same priest. The lack of self-awareness is astounding. You're the
priest on the altar, preaching down, condemning people in the audience. You're exactly one of those old-style priests.
You're just sitting on your couch in your jocks and your socks, eating your smashed avocado and talking on Twitter to strangers. But you're doing the exact same thing, and you don't even understand what you're doing. And I think that, like, years from now, we'll look back on this in the same way as we look back on times when women, for example, obviously that's a bugbear for me, but like, all types of people, gay people, women, anybody who was marginal or considered to be easily marginalised in any way in Ireland, well, it was done so. And now we'll look back on this period and go, yeah, that was the time when we got so het up about what had happened before that we just started doing the exact same thing to everyone else.
We might have gone a little too far with that one. Yeah.
Pendulum needs to come back into the middle there a little bit.
Yeah, well, so I suppose really what we're discussing in this podcast is the fact that there are certain topics that haven't been kind of discussed and seem to not be able to be discussed by our political system. And that's going to be a running theme, hopefully, through the Unsafe Space. Nothing is off the table. We can talk about everything and debate everything without getting to the stage where, you know, people have to be running away and hiding under the covers and whimpering to themselves. As Sarah is fond of saying, you know, facts don't care about your feelings.
And if you want a topic to be discussed, you should just let Keith know on Twitter, because he's always permanently on there and I'm not. I try to avoid it.
You'll catch me on Twitter I think I'm still using the old counselor one. It's at
Can't let it go.
At CLLRK Redmond. And you'll get Sarah at Sarah Cat Ryan. Although she's never on it. She's on Instagram taking pictures of her dinner the whole time.
And our children. So just actually one more thing on that. So you're still using your CLLO or your counsellor whatever on your thing. But in one of the previous podcasts, you just said, I'm not a counsellor anymore, but you didn't say why, you didn't say how. And like, people might think you lost your seat. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about why you decided, after being democratically elected, not like me, I just got turfed out, you know, but you actually decided not to run. So why don't you tell us why?
Well, the short answer is...
That I kept moaning at you about not being home.
Well, the short answer is I had... When I ran for election, I was single. I had no kids.
Yeah.
This time around, I have two kids under three. And as anybody who has small kids will know, it's a full, full-on thing. The notion of going off to some council meeting or going to meet a constituent, you know, after work in the evening rather than seeing my kids before they went to bed just became a bit of a, I don't really think so. Plus the fact that being a counsellor in and of itself, once you see behind the curtain, you realise there's actually nothing there. There's no power. They don't have to do anything. It's really...
Sorry, take that back. You did a lot of work about... stopping the 155 grand being spent on conserving the grey squirrel on hotel.
30 grand. Sorry, and they still spent 28. But no, these are minor wins. The whole thing is, like, are you willing to sacrifice all of your private time, your family time, to do these kind of small things? And really, there's no executive power as a councillor. There's no ability to do anything that the city manager or county manager doesn't want you to do. It's a bit of a kind of a... It's a bit of a crash for aspiring TDs. They start off as councillors and they move on. So if you've no great aspiration to do that, there's kind of not really much point to it, I don't think, unless you want to be a local celebrity.
You don't want to be a TD?
No, I'd rather be...
Benevolent dictator?
I'd rather be a benevolent dictator. Give me 5 years, I'll fix this country. But so I didn't run is the answer. I didn't run in the election And I'm not. I don't really regret that. I think I did my 5 years. I'm happy that I did it, and it's an itch I scratch. But I don't really see a need to do another 5 years. But if somebody wants to appoint me to the Shannon to give out about things, then no problem. I'm happy to do that.
So you'll sit in the Senate until 11 o'clock at night. That's different.
I bring the two lads in.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you're exactly what politics should have, but it just doesn't work. Yeah. Like, I can't imagine now. Obviously, I was single when I was councillor and running as well. And I just can't imagine that life with two kids.
Yeah. And it does come back to the discussion about women in politics, because women are primary kind of caregivers still pretty much in Ireland for children. And so that ability to kind of marry, you know, rearing children and having a job, which is very long hours and stuff. So, you know, we will probably come back to this, I think.
Because I have a few, you know. I have like that, I never know how to say this. Do I stay at home? I do a bit of work for myself. I do a bit of consulting work from home. I'm doing a law degree as well, so that kind of takes up a bit of my time. But I am the predominant childcare, and we have a little bit of help lately, but up until then it was just me. And I choose to do that, and I'm very happy to do so, and I'm very lucky to be able to do that. And don't get me wrong, I know that's a privilege. But when a few months ago there was was it the National Women's Council? National Other Women's Council, not me anyway, released this, they did this study, and they found that women, a huge percentage of women actually wanted to stay at home. Yeah. And the woman who was doing the press release about it said that the result had been like a punch in the gut. And I just had to laugh and be like, that pretty much sums it up. So my choice actually doesn't fit in with the agenda.
But I mean,
and so I'm suddenly offensive. Like, I thought it was that women should be allowed to do whatever we want to do. And what I want to do, and what I genuinely want to do, I'm 36, I have two kids, I may have another two. And I want to be at home, and I'm able to do that, and that's great for me. But being told that that decision is somehow like offensive or hurtful to women,
some women choose to stay at home, some women choose to go to work. This is what it's supposed to be all about. It's supposed to be empowering women to make those choices. Then that somebody wants to stay at home is a punch in the gut to, like, the National Women's Council of Ireland. Just shows you the National Women's Council of Ireland do not represent, you know, women.
I mean, no.
they're so distanced from
that,
so,
like,
many women that they can't actually envisage that these women exist.
And when I look at, like, I'm 36, I had my first child when I was 33. I have two children. I was the first of my close friends to have a baby, but now all of my friends have kids now. And, like, most, 9 out of 10 of my friends would say, if I could, I'd stay at home. Mm. Like, privately, they'd say, if I could work it out, to stay at home and not work, I would.
Even for a few years, yeah.
And exactly. No, I'm not saying, like, I'm not doing a law degree so that I could shout at Law and Order Special Victims Unit at the weekend. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've no intention of staying home forever, but I want to try and be at home for the moment. And I don't think that that should be considered like some kind of, that I'm some kind of, you know, disappointment to the female whatever, like, agenda. I just think that, like, and you read all these articles all the time, and I was laughing. It's like, oh, the brain drain. There's all these women at home, and they're master's educated, and they have this and they have that, and they're just sitting at home or whatever. Yeah, I am sitting at home, and yeah, I am. And I paid loads of tax while I worked. I earned good money. I paid huge amount of taxes on it, and now I'm staying at home for a while I raise my kids, who will also pay absolutely shocking amount levels of tax in this country when they grow up, and then I'll go back to work eventually. Why is that a problem? Should we not be celebrating that? Should we not be saying, you do you? Like, that's all I hear all the time, you do you. Unless you doing you doesn't fit in with the agenda, in which case then you're just like a punch in the gut.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's so much there that we're going to unpack in other podcasts. You know, the notion of women's roles in society, potentially gender quotas, parenting, all kinds of stuff. So this has been The Unsafe Space. This has been our third episode, and tune in for more. I'm really, I think we're getting into our groove now. Begin to enjoy it.
Thank you for listening.
And do contact us on Twitter. If you have any ideas that you want us to discuss, if you want to give out, very happy to receive your complaints. I file them all very down.
Or if you've been following Keith avidly for a few years and you're just sick and tired of his shit on Twitter and you just want to hear somebody take a few strips on him, please contact me and I will do it for you.
Defend himself. Okay, well, anyway, this has been the third episode of The Unsafe Space, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Bye.